us that way as being amoral.
With this evening's guest, James Clarkson, career investigator, UFO investigator, author, and lecturer. Welcome, everyone. This is Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest is James Clarkson. A Global Focus broadcasts live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN 105.7 FM, New Orleans. Thank you to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. This evening, everyone at the network and in the network discussion room on Pal Talk wishes a happy birthday to Dee Andrew, host of the popular program Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, broadcast on Saturday nights on this UPRN network. We all admire Dee, an excellent field historian, researcher, program host, and individual. Also, greetings to Dee's husband, David Andrew, a fine researcher and writer. A wonderful weekend to both of you, Dee and David. Now, tonight's guest, our guest, James E. Clarkson, is a UFO investigator, author, and lecturer. In 1974, James Clarkson enlisted in the U.S. Army and served as a military police investigator at Fort Lewis, Washington, earning an Army Commendation Medal for his investigative work prior to his honorable discharge in 1977. His military service resulted in an ongoing interest in the field of investigations. A career investigator, James Clarkson served for 20 years with the Aberdeen, Washington Police. James retired as a sergeant with assignments as detective sergeant, patrol sergeant, fatal accident team supervisor, and field training officer supervisor. He has successfully completed 20 years of ongoing and specialized training in the field of criminal investigation and police operations from the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission. In 1987, James Clarkson joined MUFON and began over 20 years of being an advocate to his fellow officers and the public, lecturing at regional libraries in five Washington state counties and becoming known as the UFO cop to the deputies and officers in Grays Harbor County on the southwest Washington coast. In 1993, James Clarkson met June Crane and became both her friend and the primary researcher into her past when she worked in classified laboratories at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from 1943 to 1953. June Crane asked James Clarkson to, quote, tell my story, end quote, before she died in 1998. Her revelations became an important testimony in support of the Majestic Documents Research Project. June Crane's story, the interview transcript, is available on the Majestic Documents website and has been featured in The Secret, as seen on the Sci-Fi Channel, and on an episode of the UFO Files titled Hangar 18. James Clarkson published June Crane's account in his recent book, Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force and UFOs. In addition, James also serves as a member of the investigation team on the Majestic Documents. James' website can be found at clarksonufo.com. Also, everyone, I suggest that my listeners hear the podcast of Dee Andrew's interview with James Clarkson, which discussion was excellent. The podcast can be found in the archives of the UPRN network under the name of the program which Dee Andrew hosts, Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. And James, I can't wait to review that book of yours, Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force and UFOs. It looks like a major development in this field. And welcome to the program, James.
Good evening, Trace. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. Well, you know, boy, was I impressed. Your expertise as a career investigator, plus your years of extensive research in the ufology field, are of great interest to me and the audience. Now, sir, would you feel that this ufology field really merits, truly merits, an investigator's focus with the proper emphasis on investigation protocols? What would be your thoughts on that, James?
Well, I absolutely agree with that statement, and I would also point out that I'm not alone. There are many very dedicated investigators in this field who are either going solo or who are members of organizations who have strong law enforcement, scientific or aviation and military backgrounds. And all of these individuals take their professional experience and apply it to researching this mystery. And actually, investigations, I believe it is an art rather than a science, but it's also work. And that's probably the thing that I emphasize most, is that it is a matter of logically following a progression of steps and looking for the things that don't fit into the conventional patterns, and basically trying to arrive at a logical conclusion from a series of facts. That's really the heart of it. And also, in any investigation, whether it's UFOs or a homicide or traffic accident or whatever, there is a person who doesn't really exist that all true investigators are playing to, and that's kind of your audience. And the law calls this person the reasonable man or the reasonable woman. In other words, this is a person who represents the common man and someone who could be convinced or not convinced by the evidence that you're developing as you go through your investigation. In other words, I'm always asking myself the question, can I objectively explain something? In other words, how far can I go? And I always make that as a distinction from speculation. And that's probably what I believe sets a true investigator apart from someone who is just a casual researcher or a pure advocate or I hate to use the word, but someone who's just in it as a hobby.
Boy, that's well said, James. Looking at the transcript and your articles, I'm really impressed by this emphasis you have on investigation protocols. You're really looking with that evidentiary eye, and you appreciate the forensics aspect, too, in ufology research. James, I've got so many questions here. I know my audience, I call them my audience, but they're really my fellow colleagues. They're right now in the PAL Talk auditorium, the discussion room, and of course we will be having thousands right now listening online because this particular network is very, very popular, the UFO Paranormal Radio Network or UPRN Network. James, could we start out with June Crane first? That was really exciting. You performed a great service to the ufology field by your research, interviews, and book on the account of June Crane, a civilian employee with a high clearance level at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from the years 1942 to 1952. I hope I had that correct. I might have said 53 in the opening. Now, your interview with June Crane can be found at the Majestic Document site at www.majesticdocuments.com, where you also serve as one of the team investigators. Also, details on ordering your book, Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force and UFOs, can be found at your website, clarksonufo.com. James, what an exciting research assignment you had. I believe you completely fulfilled the important mission June Crane gave you to tell her story, and you didn't realize that her attorney had prepared a notarized affidavit before her passing, which affidavit granted you the rights to June's life story.
That is correct, and in fact, ironically, just within the last week, that particular affidavit saved the day. I applied for a copyright to my book over a year ago, and due to the amount of material that the United States Copyright Office receives, I guess it's not too surprising that it takes a year before your submission gets to the top of the pile. But they were actually going to delay my copyright of the book, and I sent them a scan of that particular document, and that's what carried the day, because they immediately wrote back and said, well, okay, now we recognize that, you know, this story does indeed belong to you. And I actually posed the question to them, because I'm always a little bit suspicious. I wanted to know if this was purely a question about copyright law, or perhaps there was some motivation to stall or delay the copywriting of my book because of the UFO subject matter. You can't help but, if you're involved in this subject, you're always a little bit suspicious of the government. There's really no way around that.
Very true. And, you know, James, you mentioned that June Crane took her loyalty oath very seriously. As to her highly classified position at Wright-Patterson, June apparently was greatly honored to be such an employee, but felt that the public observed to know the truth on UFOs. Do you feel similarly?
I absolutely believe that. Down in the core of my being, I believe that where we are in the universe, whether it's makes us all important or whether it makes us as small as the smallest creature on the earth, the truth of who we are and why we're here belongs to every single person and everybody on the entire world. And I personally am not afraid of this. I don't think that most people are afraid of it. I think everybody wants to know the truth, and they sense that there has been a great deal of lying, regardless of what the motivation was for the lie. These lies and censorship have gone on too long, and all they've done is create more distrust, a lack of confidence in our government, and a lot of cynicism amongst the young people who should be brought into the fold, so to speak, and should believe that our institutions truly are transparent and representative.
That's beautifully said, James. Those arguments of yours are extremely powerful. Let me see. Before we continue with June, may I ask a very quick question? We have one of our researchers here who wants to know, and I don't know this individual, could you be related to a Jeremy Clarkson? I don't know the reference.
I really don't know. Clarkson is a much more common last name than I thought, and there are a lot of Clarksons around that I've never heard of. And the only way I could probably help this person with their question would be to determine whether or not Jeremy Clarkson traces his lineage to people in Kentucky.
Oh, interesting. Now, you know, James, I could tell from the preface to her transcript that you believe June was blessed with great discernment and bravery. Now, the transcript notes that her initial employment credits included catching a spy. I guess June did this through tracking suspicious requisitioning of classified documents. She was a youngster at the time. She was 17 or 18 in 1942, I believe it was, responsible for 17 safes. And the material the spy was focusing on, whom June helped catch, concerned a military theater of operations. I believe it must have been during World War II. That's
correct.
Really impressive. What did you think on that? Boy, that's quite an achievement.
I think that, like most people who accomplish something extraordinary, at the time that they're going through it, they're not thinking that. June was trained to do her job. She took it very seriously. She was a very intelligent young woman, and in an environment like that, of course, thinking about World War II, the motto was loose lips sink ships, and they made security an extremely serious issue where she worked. In fact, it's described in there at one point during her career, her job was to be in charge of about a dozen safes, and she would log in and out classified material on the basis of whether or not the person had the right security clearance and whether or not they had a need to know. Well, my understanding of how she caught this lady who was involved in espionage was that she discovered that this woman was taking out files that were not properly returned when they were supposed to be, and she began to become suspicious. And, you know, she turned the lady in, basically, because she felt that it was her duty. And I recall that she explained that even that was a difficult decision because this woman had some sort of a physical disability. But this was during wartime, and June was very loyal to her country. She was very patriotic. And that plays into the amount of personal difficulty that she had making up her mind to tell me what she knew about UFOs, because it basically took her 4 years from the time she first approached me. So she was very patriotic, but I think that at the time she was involved in with the spy, she was just doing what she thought she was supposed to in her office by reporting suspicious activity.
Thank you. No, thank you for those details. Very, very intriguing, James. And you know, you note that June Crane never recanted her story. You reference that the author and researcher Kevin Randall included part of June Crane's story in his book, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, and that June's accounts have remained consistent through the years. Also, she never sought recognition or money from her account. Now, those are strong factors, further strong factors as to credibility. Do you think?
Absolutely. And there's actually one more after that.
Mm.
After she left her employment at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, she suffered a very serious medical condition, and as a complication, her vision was slightly impaired for the rest of her life. And so although she was a very strong advocate for libraries, in fact, she led the charity drive in the city where she lived to have a new library built, June herself had a lot of difficulty reading. And I noted when I went to her house, which I did many times in order to complete this work and because I was her friend, she did not have two shelves full of UFO books. And I'm not saying that, you know, people who do have genuine UFO experiences, it's perfectly legitimate for them to reach out and say, okay, I'd like to own books that tell me more about this subject. But it's just one of those little investigative clues that she's telling me all these, you know, extremely significant details, and yet at the same time, she didn't have any of the popular books about UFOs at her fingertips, and she probably couldn't see well enough to read them anyway. So in other words, she was telling me what she genuinely believed.
Very intriguing. She sounds like a extremely accomplished lady. Also, she was a philanthropist. But now I've got a very interesting question, James, coming into our from our discussion room, our research colleagues in there. Hi there. This is from the lady Prism Tuesday. She's a brilliant psychic. She also had her own host. She also was a co-host of a program here on the UPRN network. It had a record audience. It was wonderful. And Prism's, or Tuesday's, question is, when mentioning the government, what part of the government did she work for? Now, was it the Wright-Patterson base? She was part of the stenographical team. She did receive promotions. She was in both the Parachute Project Department, the Arabee
Parachute
Project. Yes, Parachute Branch. Thank you. The Arabee Rocket Project. Also to work relating to the study of UFOs. How would you describe it, James?
Well, you have to put her work in context. And this is part of what makes June such an interesting story. Even if you didn't have UFOs, this would be a worthwhile story. First off, she pointed out that if you were growing up as a young person in Dayton, Ohio, in 1941, if you wanted a good job, you went to work for the government. And the reason was that after December 7th, 1941, when Pearl Harbor happened, before that time, there was a Wright Field, which was a basically unsecured, small Army Air Corps facility. There was no Wright-Patterson Air Force Base because there was no Air Force. And while June was working, the Air Force was being born. In other words, throughout World War II, you had the Army Air Corps. This location in Dayton, Ohio, became more and more critical, more and more important. This is where the first wind tunnels were, the first places where they started doing serious experimentation on how to develop combat aircraft. And after World War II, this was the center from which they dispatched people to the American Southwest, and of course later on they had centers like Los Alamos and, you know, White Sands, where they would actually launch rockets in our rocketry program after World War II. But all of this information and research came back through this location where June worked. And so in other words, she was working there at a critical time when Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the Air Force were being born. So my understanding of her work was that she was multitasked. In other words, they would use her because she was a really good clerk stenographer wherever they needed her, although she would have a particular office that she reported to. In other words, she had a supervisor, etc., or she worked in a particular command throughout her career, but they changed her responsibilities as they needed. And that also included, back in the day, this is of course when there was email, long before there were personal computers, email, anything like that, and they actually used to send out responses to people who would report UFOs to the Air Force. And she told me laughingly about how she would type out this standard response letter to someone telling them that what they had reported from an engineering perspective was impossible. In other words, it was kind of a standard dismissal paragraph. And this was work that she was doing to assist Blue Book,
that
early parts of that.
That was fascinating, James. Thank you so much for that explanation. And just as a clarification there, that question came in from Tuesday Miles, who co-hosted with Angela Thomas a wonderful program on the UPR portal. Thank you very much, Prism. Thank you, Tuesday. Great question. Now, James, you know, I'm dying to go into a couple of these questions here, and we're getting further questions here. June's responsibilities, indeed, were full spectrum there. For example, for the parachute department work, she would actually go out into the field and shoot them down with the rifle.
That was really unusual, and I have never been able to corroborate that, and I think in order to do that, I would have to find someone who knew something about the early research into parachutes, and that was a fascinating story, and it had so much detail in it that, you know, I was amazed by it. And yet it made sense because here they were trying to do somewhat risky research, which was how to drop a payload from a parachute, and they were apparently attempting to do this in an urban area. So I can see where they might have to have an emergency procedure to bring that chute down in the event that it started to go where it shouldn't go.
Boy, that's intriguing. You know, that concept of the extensive research and development projects or work there, important wartime, and also security and our defense projects there. June seems to emphasize, James, that Wright-Patterson was an experimental center. And now, at one point, the transcript notes it was designated the WADC Wright Air Development Center. Now, June also mentions the experimental portion being moved to Baltimore, and it's becoming NASA. Did
that
I understand
part
that correctly?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that part. I just reported that the way it was. There are still aspects of June's story that I have not 100% researched, and I'm not sure what she exactly meant by that.
Well, you know, so many of her generation now have passed. I guess she was apparently the last survivor of the parachute department there.
She believed that she was because she was certainly the youngest when she worked there.
And, you know, what I think is so fascinating, too, is if I interpret this correctly, June noted on a few occasions there in the transcript that given her experience there and proximity too with these engineers and others, those explanations as to the Roswell event really were not reasonable, that she would have known properties of parachutes. And it's really very, very convincing that, for example, she was saying that the dummy type would not have had really the facial features that was presented in, I think it might be the last explanation for Roswell, or one of them anyway, and also that there wouldn't have been a dummy attached to the parachute. I found that really interesting.
That really was, and of course she was seeing it from the point of view of the facility that was in charge of the research, and this is one of those areas where I wish that I had more time with June and I could have really explored all of these details further. But the bottom line is they have gotten away with trying to say that all reports of alien bodies are because of mistakes made by civilian witnesses who couldn't tell the difference between a 3.5 foot to 4 foot high gray and a 6 foot high mannequin that's made to look like a soldier, not to mention the fact that it had a plaque on it that said, if found, please return for a $25 reward. And the last I checked, I don't think there are too many extraterrestrials that wear plaques like that.
That's a very good point. Now, you know, James, something else that I found very, very intriguing was June's comments regarding her being assigned the task of taking dictation from Dr. Wernher von Braun for a 3-hour period one night. Apparently, he was a prisoner still. It was at the time of, I guess, the inception of Project Paperclip. And interesting detail. I know at this point it's very difficult to corroborate, but you know, as a former person who has taken a shorthand back in her youth, 3 hours would really have been painful. 1 hour is painful, actually. And I guess the dictation related to the rocketry program, and I believe it might have had something to do with that. It references the budget, the necessity for the budget, and probably the rocketry technical terms. Sounds very interesting.
Well, that is one of the key stories that June related to me, and I would point out the most interesting thing from an investigative viewpoint is that June is the person who pointed out to me that there was no corroboration for her story, and yet she was absolutely adamant that it was Wernher von Braun from whom she took the dictation. And she kept describing how cold his eyes were and that this man was very insensitive to the fact that she was standing. She was not given a chair. Basically, this was a hardship to take all of this dictation. And yet, every time June told me this story, she started crying. And the reason that she cried was that this officer who had taken her to do this dictation, I mean, I don't know how exactly true this was, but apparently he praised June by telling her to make her feel good, saying, you know, the work that you've done on this, if we get the money that we are asking for based upon this report, that you will have had your moment in history because you will have helped with the foundation of the United States space program. And June felt a lot of patriotic pride in that moment. And she also felt very torn, and this is where June goes beyond just being a witness to being a real person and somebody who was going through personal hardship that I think many women could relate to even now, which is that her husband did not support her in her career aspirations. She was a young mother, and at the same time she was working in this job that kept getting better and better, and they asked her if she could come on board and help, and you know, basically become a secretary or what they would probably now call an office manager, yes, in the fledgling space program. And so she was very, very proud, and yet she felt at the same time that she couldn't do the thing that she wanted to do most. And that's why whenever she recalled this memory, it was a moment of pride and pain for her.
And also, the transcript notes that, excellent document, the transcript notes that she actually had to type her shorthand notes or stenographic notes that night, and that must have been quite a chore. It shows her dedication.
Exactly, and there was pressure. The way she explained it to me was that she was told that she could not go home until that shorthand was properly transcribed, and it was all a finished product, which might fit into a supposition that I've had, is that perhaps she was correct, and she did indeed take dictation for Wernher von Braun, and he was only going to be at Wright-Patterson for a short period of time, and therefore the report had to be completed, and he had to review it and approve it before it could be passed on through channels, and therefore they had to do it as quickly as possible because they were taking him back to where he was permanently assigned. Now, that is a possible scenario that would explain why there was so much pressure on June to complete this report.
And, you know, it sounds very, very plausible. Also, I think one detail that really intrigued me was that at that point, Dr. Wernher von Braun was escorted by military personnel with guns, with armed personnel. And, of course, apparently he became a member of that program. Did I reference correctly that he signed a contract or he signed documents? I'm not quite sure if I remember that correctly. I do know the transcript references that several German scientists were housed at the Wright-Patterson facility. June mentioned that, for example, there were about 40 in one of the compounds and that the families were later able to join them and that they were treated much better here in the United States than they were in Germany at that time during World War II.
All of those statements that you've just made have been corroborated by me by reading historical accounts related to Project Paperclip. There are at least five different books that I've researched that all have a lot of detail about Paperclip. This is an extremely interesting piece of history because the United States was really in a quandary there. Most of the public did not want anyone who had been affiliated with the Nazi Party to be brought to the United States for any reason after World War II, and I don't think it's a big leap to figure out why, because, you know, our soldiers had gone to Europe, and many of them didn't come home fighting the Nazis, and the idea that we would bring the Nazi scientists to the United States was morally appalling. And yet at the same time, when World War II ended, it was obvious that we were going to go toe-to-toe with the Russians, and both sides were engaged. In fact, I think Britain was and several other countries. Everybody was trying to grab as many German rocket scientists as they could get because it was obvious that rocketry was going to be the next stage for the development of ballistic weapons.
Boy, that's intriguing. And, you know, you mentioned as well that her office also was connected with the Arabee rocket project. I hope I'm correctly pronouncing this. The
yes, Arabee it is. It's Arabee.
Arabee, thank you. The Arabee, A-E-R-O-B-E-E, rocket project.
Correct.
Boy, that sounded interesting. Could you give us some details on that or just a reference?
Well, first off, you can look up that word in Wikipedia and get a good
thank
definition.
You.
But the Arabee rocket was our first successful rocket created directly from German technology, specifically the V-2 rocket program, which Wernher von Braun was, I believe, in charge of at Peenemünde facility. And this was a very important development because this rocket was also known as our first heavy lifter. In other words, this rocket was powerful enough to lift a heavy payload up to the edge of space. And up until then, no one had been able to do that. So this was a key development for the United States. So the Arabee program was extremely important. This is what you would call a very sensitive program that would have a lot of security around it.
Boy, that's interesting. Now, you know, James, on the subject of identifying flying objects, June notes in her transcript that she heard of them beginning in 1951 or 1952 and talking about these experimental, or these rocket programs, rather. Numerous UFOs were seen at White Sands, New Mexico, during the missile tests. And she has these two interesting quotes from her transcript. First was, quote, "They said they were just as thick as stars," end quote. And this was when, quote, "they were doing the Arabee rocket test," end quote. Boy, that's interesting.
Well, that I believe, in other words, her conversation style, she's recalling things from 50 years ago in her life. So I believe she also made the comment to me that they said the UFOs were as thick as fleas. Now, that may
yes.
be her way of describing the fact that these scientists came back and said that they constantly saw UFOs. They felt like they were under surveillance. It was routine for them to see UFOs. This has all been historically corroborated. I mean, this, You know, June was able to tell me that because she heard it from these people, but other researchers have also said this another way, which, you know, you can go through the history of the green fireballs that were researched by the Air Force over sensitive installations throughout the Southwest and the Western United States during the same period of time. You can go through any number of accounts, people who've had sightings in that same area, and you get the same sense that it was not uncommon for people who were engaged in research related to rocketry to also have UFO sightings at the same time. It seems to me that I remember in the book by Gordon Cooper, Leap of Faith, that when he was at an Air Force base, this would be years later in California, they had a very direct kind of in-your-face UFO sighting of a craft that landed, a classic saucer, on a tripod. They filmed it. They watched it, several witnesses, and, of course, they sent the film away and never saw it again. But this occurred while they were conducting research. In other words, they were out in the field doing research on rocketry or jets or something like that. So this theme that it appears that UFOs have placed some of our experiments under surveillance, this shows up over and over again.
Boy, those are intriguing comments there. You know, pardon me, pardon me, James. Gordon Cooper, if I remember that correctly, President Dennett was mentioning his book on California UFOs. I believe, if I remember correctly, that footage went directly to Washington forthwith. Now, on you were correct about that other report too. On White Sands, there were reports of UFOs, quote, just as thick as fleas there, end quote, of all shapes and types. Boy, quite a spectrum of UFO types were seen there. That's very intriguing. Also, it notes that the engineers and scientists would be forced to remain in a locked motel room to write what they saw.
I think that's standard debriefing procedure.
Really? Very difficult?
Well, they accomplished two things with one stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Because by detaining people and making it very uncomfortable, you discourage them from talking amongst themselves or making further reports. Because as June pointed out, nobody wants to be locked up for 24 hours, so after a while, you're not going to report anything no matter what you see. So if your goal is to censor the UFO phenomena, you've accomplished that part of the mission. But at the same time, if someone has seen something and it does get to you, by making them write it down over and over again and interviewing them over and over again under pressure, you're probably going to squeeze out as many details as possible about what they actually saw or experienced. Because you've got them in a high-pressure environment. In other words, if this person holds a security clearance and that's their job, and you're detaining them in order to tell you what they know, that's what you would call an involuntary interview.
That's very intriguing information. That's very intriguing information. Thank you. Well, you've spent over two decades as an investigator, and boy, I find that very intriguing to get the fullest amount of details, as well as dissuade the subject, but at the same time getting the most accurate, detailed account. But that's interesting. Well, you know, if you don't mind, James, I'd like to go further into June's recollections. For example, she mentions bringing in the two men, the alien individuals, in Wright-Patterson and placing them in the ice box. And please correct me if I'm incorrectly describing this. The person who accompanied the two bodies, alien bodies, was a master sergeant with the first name Clarence.
That's correct.
Excellent. And Clarence discussed this with the other individuals having Clarence while they were having morning coffee.
Precisely. And there is a context for that conversation. Now, this main interview that I did with June that is the focus of the book, there's one point about this that does need to be emphasized. Now, when I asked her, it took me several times going to her house and talking about this, before she was willing to have me take out a tape recorder. And although she said she was willing to be tape recorded, there was still a little reluctance on her part. And so that was why she wanted me to read this letter that she had written previously, and why she was, I had to kind of prime the pump, I guess is a crude way of saying it, but sometimes you have to do that during an interview because you want to hear the details and people are reluctant. But she told me that the way the conversation started was that this man came in for coffee and he was upset, and everybody asked him why he was upset, and he said because there had been a crash, and everybody who was privy to the conversation made a mistake, an obvious mistake. They thought that he was talking about the crash of a military aircraft, and everybody was worried that maybe one of their friends had been killed or injured in the crash. And that's when he corrected everybody and said, no, I'm not talking about an airplane. I'm talking about a flying saucer, and I'm talking about non-humans. And I asked her, well, where did they put them? And she said, the AeroMed Lab. And she made a comment. She said, that place was so restricted, she didn't know, she couldn't get in there. Nobody she knew could get in there. But that's where she thought they put the bodies.
Boy, that's fascinating. You know, James, on that instilling of fear to keep secrecy, and just on what you just said here, you mentioned that the day of the discussion of the little men on the little men being brought to the base, actually this is the transcript, from the transcript, a memo was passed hand to hand that had to be signed by the personnel as to not repeating the rumor or be liable to immediate dismissal or a $20,000 fine or a 20-year jail term. And June, with the others in the parachute branch, brought this memo, and the staff there had to sign it.
That's correct, and it was called a too-hot memo. And mm-hmm. It's interesting because she called it a too-hot memo, and when I called it that in the presence of the key investigators for the Majestic documents, Ryan Wood and Bob Wood, that's when basically their antenna went up, and they said, that's when they got really interested in the June story because they said, there's only a few people who've ever talked about two hot memos. And so the fact that June would be able to talk about this and know what it was, that's very significant. Just like the fact that she said that there was not one crashed UFO, that by the time she left the employment of the government, they knew about at least three and possibly more UFO crash recoveries. That fact is not known to most researchers, especially at the time she made the disclosure to me.
Boy, that's intriguing. Now, on other crash sites, maps were discussed in the transcript, including the proving grounds. And make sure, too, that I'm saying this accurately, James. I've had rather an intense week. Maps were discussing, including the proving grounds at White Sands. And now, also, there was a reference to the Salton Sea over in California. And also to a Sierra Vista. And with Sierra Vista, is that Sierra Vista, California? That's what I'm thinking it is. But I also had a fellow researcher say it could be Sierra Vista, Arizona.
And that could well be true. In other words, that's one of those things where, and this is where I had to be, when you do this kind of an interview, okay, bear in mind that June was in her early 70s when I interviewed her. This interview occurs late at night, and you can tell when you're talking to a person when they start to get a little tired.
Yes.
So you've got to be careful that you don't push too hard. Much as an interviewer, I would love to have taken every single thing that she told me and asked her every last detail and basically wrung out, things to the nth degree. Many of these things that she gave me, like these details, are what you would call tantalizing because they point towards things, but they don't exactly identify them. And, of course, we all know now that there are several possible UFO crashes that would fit those parameters, starting with Cape Girardeau in Missouri in 1941. We could be talking about Kingman, Arizona. We could be talking about Aztec, New Mexico. There apparently is also another possible crash site inside Mexico. I mean, there's several places that would all support June's statement that they had already researched multiple UFO crash sites by the time she left their employment.
Yep, those are very plausible. That's a very plausible argument. Very, very reasonable. James, June did mention that the AeroMed lab at Wright-Patterson had the bodies, correct? Or at least two of the bodies.
That's correct.
Crashes. James, have you heard in your research of these bodies being moved elsewhere in the United States? To a different branch of the military or elsewhere in the United States?
Well, I've heard of bodies being kept other places, but for these specific bodies going somewhere, no. In other words, people have talked about Dulce, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. They've talked about other Air Force bases. Supposedly, I believe President Nixon and Jackie Gleason spent a weekend at an Air Force base in Florida where there was a possible sighting of bodies. I mean, there are a number of locations where some of this research may have occurred.
Thank you. No, that's very informative. Now, James, if you could kind of tie in for me here, June was referencing the Araby Blue Book, and it seemed that there was almost a code description for craft which couldn't possibly fly. Those craft which couldn't possibly fly, perhaps by our aviation or avionics standards, would suggest that they would be UFOs. Am I interpreting this correctly? And such incidents would be investigated immediately?
Well, what she pointed out to me is something that is... we all know is true, but she was telling this to me as an insider. She kind of thought this was all very ironic and said that this was kind of funny because her job was to type up this standard form letter to tell someone, what you've reported is impossible from an engineering viewpoint, basically a letter of dismissal telling people to go away, and she was letting me know that the very same reports were being shunted off some other way and seriously investigated by the Air Force. So, in other words, this is this classic, go away, don't bother me. That's your public response to UFOs, and your private response is, oh, my God, we better go investigate this right now.
Thank you for clarifying that for me. James, I have some interesting questions here about Washington UFOs. I found this June Crane research so intriguing, though I wanted to just complete it. We have about 6 more minutes until the 10-minute break. Let me see here. I wanted to reference, James, that signs of June's credibility were the fact that the documents she showed you had War Department markings on them. Also, she references the fact that she had to secure the ribbon when she was preparing the documents and afterwards. And also that one time June got into she was really rather chewed out because she had to type a forwarding paragraph for a particularly secret project named Caucasian. I think it was 1952. And she had left a carbon, I believe, on that paragraph in her draw inadvertently, and she was chewed out for that.
That's correct, and the Project Caucasian is one of the strongest corroborating elements of June's testimony, because after I took the main interview from June, then, of course, it wasn't but a few months later that she passed away, and I began seriously researching this story, and in fact, for quite a few months, I had no idea what to do with this story. All I knew is I had this wonderful woman who was my friend who was gone, and I had all of her personal papers, and I didn't know what to do with it, but one of the things she told me about was Project Caucasian, and it didn't matter where I looked or who I contacted, all I got was a blank stare or no record whenever I asked about Project Caucasian. And interestingly enough, it wasn't until about the year, I believe, 2000 or 2000, as late as 2002, Project Caucasian was declassified. And up until then, even the name was top secret, because it turns out to be the code name of the project for building a harness to support a hydrogen bomb that was to be dropped from the belly of a B-36 bomber. And, of course, this is an extremely technical proposition to design the proper harness, to put the right number of parachutes with the right size. Everything has to be timed properly because, obviously, you're putting a payload that weighs tons underneath a parachute and dropping it out of a bomber, and the goal is that the bomb will go off at exactly the right altitude and that enough time will have elapsed so that the pilot can get the bomber out of the area. And outrunning a hydrogen bomb blast, you know, that's going to take some serious flying.
Yes.
So the point being, this was an extremely sensitive, top-secret program, and June knew about it. So this, to me, proved that she was involved in top-secret research, or she wouldn't have even known the name. And she pointed out to me that every time Project Caucasian got brought up, her boss turned white. In other words, this was something that was really sensitive. And so this was what I call the key corroborating fact. And her description of the security procedures, you got to put it in historical context. No personal computers. Everything is typed on a manual typewriter. It has a ribbon. The ribbon could be recovered by an enemy agent. A carbon paper could be recovered by an enemy agent. Everything about June's work had security provisions around it to prevent espionage because it was a serious threat, first by German agents and then by Russian agents, because obviously they would like to know all about this kind of research.
Boy, that sounds fascinating. What an important assignment. Wonderful work. They did wonderful work at that department. And some of the impressive names, for example, June mentioned a lieutenant colonel by the nickname Hap Arnold, who would discuss UFOs with the engineers. James, you note that Hap Arnold was the creator of the Scientific Advisory Board, which board was headed by Dr. Theodore von Karman. Impressive work there, impressive people, including June Crane as being a very impressive individual herself.
Yes, and it was funny because her recollection of Hap Arnold, I asked her what he was like, and she just kind of laughed and said, well, he was a really handsome man. You know, June was a young woman in an all-male environment. And it was interesting to me that she brought that element in, too. And, of course, that plays into another one of her key stories because I think that she wouldn't have gotten to handle the memory medal if the man involved wasn't flirting with her.
Well, that's very intriguing. Well, you know, James, after approximately a 9-minute break here, I'd love to discuss the memory medal, your Washington State research, the great Elk River investigation of yours on that Elk River crash or reported downing, and also your chance to speak in Paris about the June Crane account. We'll be right back in about 20 seconds. I'm finding this so informative, very, very engaging. And just to let everyone know, during our break, please feel free to look at James's excellent website, which is at ClarksonUFO.com. We'll be right back in about 8 or 9 minutes.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m., it's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.giascott.com.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no younger. Your pain and your hunger, they're driving you home. And freedom, oh, freedom, well, that's just some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone. Don't your feet get cold in the wintertime? The sky won't snow and the sun won't shine. It's hard to tell the nighttime from the day. It may be raining, but there's a rainbow above you. You better let somebody love you.
Let somebody love you.
You better let somebody love you before it's too
Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti.
And we're Second Sight NYC, a psychic and paranormal radio show based out of New York City.
And Chris is a psychic that tells it like it is.
So if you want something sugar-coated,
just buy a donut.
Each week we'll have an interesting guest, and I'll do psychic readings and dream interpretations with a psychic twist.
We touch on all that is paranormal, from exorcisms to ghost hunting.
From seances to passing spirits in a light.
Yeah, and sometimes Chris gets a little carried away.
But Stephanie's always there to reel me back in. We're making the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
The Church of Natus with hosts Jeffrey Pritchett and Guy Weddle. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in, Mosh to the Apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at MavisIncarnate.com.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus, with this evening's guest, James Clarkson, career investigator, UFO investigator, author and lecturer. Welcome back, everyone, to our discussion, to our interview with James Clarkson. Now, James, you had the opportunity to present last October, I believe it was, in Paris, at a session of Les Repas Ufologiques Parisiens, your research and June Crane's story. And, of course, that particular ufology group, Les Repas Ufologiques Parisiens, is one of the premier groups in the world. Now, I, too, have visited there on a number of occasions. They must have been extremely impressed by your research. Here, quick hi to three ufologists there, Gérard Labat, Jean-Luc Robert, and Gildas Bourdais, also to Bernard Tuanel and Professor Denise Tinoclat. Now, James, what I'd like to hear from you is your impression of the French. And to me, they impressed me as individuals who just sincerely wanted to know the latest in research in this field.
Well, that's it exactly. And I felt that it was a great honor to present there. And it was in context. They were holding their meetings at a restaurant in a very modern mall in a section of Paris called La Défense, which is in the west part of Paris. It also, unfortunately, happened to be during a rail strike, so a lot of the people from the outlying areas, including Monsieur Denocla, could not attend, although he managed to meet up with us and managed to take us out for a absolutely wonderful lunch and spent time with us, and that was a great honor. But the actual presentation, they apologized because they could only get a little over 100 people there. They said normally the meeting would have had well over 200, and this, of course, is a monthly meeting. So I was very impressed with how organized they were. Also, they asked an awful lot of questions, even though there was a language barrier. Many of them are bilingual, which I discovered in Paris in general, which was that I would attempt my clumsy version of French, and I would get off about half a dozen words, and they would immediately come back at me in really good English. But the main thing they were interested in was the June story. They had not heard it before. They had not heard it directly from me, and I felt that they really understood what she was trying to tell everyone. The other thing, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but the only part where there was even a little bit of discomfort was at the time I gave this presentation, I was still the Washington State Director of MUFON, and I detected that they were not real enchanted with MUFON. And they made the comment that they thought that MUFON was already going the way of NICAP, which for those who are not familiar with history, it was the predecessor of MUFON, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. It broke up in the late 60s, and out of that, MUFON was born. But it's pretty much established by historical fact that NICAP was broken up by agents provocateurs who were basically employees of our own government. But all in all, I thought that this was a fantastic group of people. It was a great opportunity, and they made me feel extremely welcome. And in general, I felt that way the whole time I was in Paris. I never, I never had an experience where I felt like anybody was discourteous to me or looked down on me. I came away with the greatest admiration for Le Repas Ufologique and for the Parisians in general. I loved the experience of being there.
Yes, I've had very favorable experiences there as well. And, you know, your reference there to their preference for certain research groups, I know that, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but I know Joe Montaldo, International Director of ICAR, has been invited there. I think it's a question of logistics of how to get them there, but he has been invited. They're very impressed by him. Now, let's turn to the fact that in November 2009, James, you presented the June Crane story to the 7th annual UFO Crash Retrieval Convention held in Las Vegas. You also were interviewed by Linda Moulton Howe on Linda Moulton Howe. She's one of my favorite researchers, the beautiful and very bright Linda Moulton Howe, H-O-W-E, on Coast to Coast AM. You said that there's a further connection to the June Crane story and the November 2009 event.
Yes, and that's because of Ryan Wood and Bob Wood, who are the father figures behind the Crash Retrieval Conference. And that's because after June passed away, I really didn't know what to do with the story. And one night I was listening to the Art Bell radio program, and I admit that I was listening to it on duty in a patrol car. It had been snowing that night in Aberdeen. There was nothing going on, and I was parked by the river taking a break, and they had this extremely interesting program about the Majestic documents. And because I called in the next day, I was trying to get copies of the documents, which back then were not available on the internet. I called in to request the documents, and I said, oh, by the way, I'm a police sergeant in the Northwest, and I have this story of this lady who worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I have all of her personal papers, and I also had the interview transcribed. Do you have any idea who might be interested in it? Well, suddenly, I got this invitation to go to Southern California, and I walked into this room at Newport Beach at the, I think it was the Hyatt Regency or something like that, and my jaw about fell down because I had never met any of these people. And I met Linda Moulton Howe, Jim Mars, Paul Davids, who was the producer of the movie Roswell. I met Bob Wood and Ryan Wood, who have tremendous professional credentials. Everybody I met there, they were just an amazing group of people, and I got to present the June story to them. Well, that eventually led to my opportunity to present at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, and that in turn led to my getting to know an absolutely wonderful man who is one of the most dedicated UFO researchers, and that's Peter Robbins, who is a true gentleman, and I can't say enough good things about him. And he came up to me after I presented, and he looked at me and he said, when I started in this business, I had a mentor, and I'm going to do the same for you. And he was as good as his word, and that's why in 2010, I got to present all over the place in the United States and ended up presenting to Le Repas Ufologique in Paris.
Very interesting chronology there, very interesting accounts. James, on your interview with Linda Moulton Howe, and again, she has many admirers in this room, and I'm definitely an admirer of her excellent research and reporting and works, her books. What was that like on Coast to Coast, and what was the feedback that you received from it?
Well, I don't know how much feedback I got exactly, because I believe that she actually interviewed me in connection with Earth Files.
Mm-hmm.
So it still is available on there as a podcast. So I'm not sure exactly. I didn't get any direct feedback other than a very favorable response in general, and I'm sure that the June story went out to a lot of people because of, as you pointed out, how many people know and respect Linda Moulton Howe, I among them. I think we all owe her a great debt of gratitude for her commitment to this field.
I agree with you, heartily. Now, James, on MUFON, I did note your article detailing your reasons for resigning from MUFON. And, James, are you afraid that the ufology field may become a tempting field for corporate investment as to research findings?
Well, it's very interesting that you use the word corporate. And I guess if, in the interest of being succinct, if I had to sum up in one sentence why I quit MUFON, it's because it became too corporate overnight. And I suddenly, I went one day thinking that I was, I don't want to say this in an egotistical way, but I thought that since I had risen to the position of state director, that this was a position of some importance, and I basically got put in my place when I started questioning why they froze out some of my investigators. They took away one of my investigators from the case management system for no reason that anyone would explain, and another one of my investigators, whom I had personally trained, they froze her out of CMS. They gave me no explanation. I went from board member to board member, and finally I got read the riot act by one of the board members who basically said that I would obey, I would do what I was told to do, and I'm just not that kind of an individual. And since I do this because I love it, not because I'm getting paid for it, I walked out. And that's to make a long story short. Is it becoming too corporate? I think absolutely. Do I think that this will harm the field of ufology? Not ultimately, because I think that when one door closes, another door opens, and I have already discovered that there are some remarkable individuals, and one organization in particular, that I think is going to lead the way in the future. I'm not sure that we need a single, all-encompassing organization for this field.
And, James, feel free to mention the name of that organization. Also, we have a question here from one of our senior researchers, as senior in knowledge, not in years. When, and I should have remembered that from reading your article, when did you approximately leave MUFON?
It was probably, I've been out for about 3 or 4 months now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this controversy to me does seem like a shame. I know there are very good people in MUFON. I and another researcher regularly attend the MUFON meetings up in Greeley. I have found some of the presentations really interesting. Even, for example, Clifford Cliff, when he was mentioning an account of a recent star team assignment, I believe it was in the South, probably about 7 or 8, perhaps more, months back. Also, Doug Wilson was giving some really interesting accounts on his recollections as to cases, just ones he's actually events he had experienced as far as UFOs and phenomena. But you know, I have to say, I do think that non-disclosure statements and background checks for field investigators almost seems to tie in with corporate and government requirements.
I absolutely agree, and I have to say personally, this has been a real heartbreaker for me, because I was a member of MUFON since 1986, and I really was very proud of that fact, and I was very proud of the fact that I was a state director. And I guess there's an old saying, when I used to be a police officer, you'd occasionally deal with people who were very, very difficult, who were basically they would push you until you would arrest them. And another officer would say, well, why did you arrest them? And they would say, well, I reached my Popeye point. And that's because Popeye the Sailor Man would say, that's all I can stand because I can't stand no more. And that was the point that I reached in MUFON. And I really didn't like leaving. But I felt as a matter of principle that I had to. But then after I left, I suddenly started meeting other people who were either fired or who had quit. And one of them in particular, I am so grateful that I met him, is Ken Cherry, who used to be the director of Texas MUFON and was in charge of the Stephenville investigation, you know, one of the most significant UFO events of modern times. And he has started an organization called EPIC. EPIC, Extraordinary Phenomena Investigations Council, and they have a website, which I believe is epicvoyagers.net, and the thing that fascinates me about his approach is he's creating what I would call a big tent organization. So in other words, instead of just saying that UFOs have to be nuts and bolts spacecraft, we are now going to look at the broad spectrum of phenomena and give everyone a chance to present. And this means that many of the subjects that are covered may not directly relate to UFOs. But that doesn't mean that at some future point, this may not all tie together. And so I guess I'm taking a broader perspective. I'm really happy to be affiliated with him. I just found out that William Puckett, who is another key researcher, who, by the way, used to live in Ocean Shores, Washington. He's from Pacific Northwest. He is now moving to Montana. He is going to be the Montana director for EPIC. There are several other people that have left MUFON that are becoming involved in EPIC, so I'm really excited. Did I want this to happen? No. I'm very sorry that this whole situation occurred, but as a man of principle, I didn't feel like I had any choice.
Well said. Well said. Very movingly said, and your points seem very reasonable. James, from reading your articles as well, do you think that the media is sometimes used as a tool by intelligence and corporate interests, here corporate generally, to reflect their own agenda, their own interests?
I don't think there's any doubt about that for a moment. And both in terms of the fact that the media will react to the UFO phenomena largely on the basis of what you would call a knee-jerk reaction, which is they will dismiss it without even thinking about it because that's the way they've been trained and educated. You have people like Nicole Lapin of CNN, who actually was able to get on national television and refer to a meeting of some of the top ex-military people, scientists, researchers, etc., at the National Press Club, and her comment on the story is, well, when I think about people who see UFOs, I think of freaks, and that was considered to be professional journalism by CNN. I mean, that's a fact. If you take Terry Hansen's book, who I believe lives up here in the Pacific Northwest, he wrote one of the definitive books on this subject. It's called The Missing Times. I would recommend that anybody who's seriously interested in UFOs, you should find a copy of that book and read it, because it's all about how the media has been in bed with the black budget agencies from day one to suppress information about UFOs. And even to the point of pointing out that this is the one that blows my mind. I can't remember the man's name, but in the book it documents that the founder of the National Enquirer magazine, in his former career, before he started the Enquirer, he was in charge of the psychological warfare unit in the Central Intelligence Agency. And that is a mind blower. When you start thinking of the implications of that, that he would be given funding to start the National Enquirer. And that, I think, is what was being backhandedly referred to in the great comedy movie, Men in Black, where Tommy Lee Jones takes Will Smith to the newsstand, and he starts picking up all the tabloid magazines, and Will Smith is going, well, why are you doing this? And he goes, best sources of news on the planet. You know, you've got to really look at things a different way when you become involved in UFO research, and you've especially got to look at what is said and what is not said in any news story. And you've also have to always ask yourself one of the most fundamental questions that any investigator will ask, and it's a Latin phrase, and it's qui bono. You always want to say who benefits. If you want to know who did the crime, find out who benefited by it. That's where you start. You got a fraud, follow the money. I mean, this is basic investigation. And when you're dealing with the media, you have to be really suspicious because we are not told the truth. If you let me control which UFO stories get onto the wire services in the United States, and how they are spun, I can control exactly how the American people will think about UFOs. It's really that simple. You don't have to control every single UFO story. You just have to control the information at what you would call the choke points.
Boy, your arguments are extremely powerful there, James. You know, that recalls to me times when I had attended the National Press Conference after sessions there of the X Conference in D.C. The speakers would have excellent credentials. Their arguments would be very well based. There'd be evidentiary reports and other aspects there that would attest to their credibility. And the really mocking comments of the media, where it was just, it was really disgusting. It was a travesty of the media's role to inform and to just remain objective. But very well said. Now, James, I'd like to turn now to Washington. You've done some excellent research there. We have one individual, Skymon871, who has been absolutely excited about this subject. He wants to know what UFO sightings have been going on in Washington State.
Well, I'm probably not privy at this particular moment in time to the most current ones. In some respects, the ones that I'm getting now are basically from the National UFO Reporting Center, which, by the way, there's another individual that I always tip my hat to as I go by. A man I genuinely respect is Peter Davenport, who is
yes.
has been one of the pioneers, one of the hardest working UFO researchers that I've ever seen. I haven't had any particular recent cases that have really gotten to me that I have been able to verify. I have investigated a number of very significant cases that occurred in Washington State over the years, the most significant of which, of course, is the Westport crash retrieval case from 1979, which is obviously a long time ago, but is very significant because it has all of the elements of a classic crash retrieval, to include military presence, a recovery, a denial, and as I found out when I researched it even further, it looks like there was another search party that came back and looked for whatever it was that crashed, and that made the entire thing even more mysterious.
Yes, let's go over this. James, now, am I correct here? It is also known as the Elk River UFO crash. Now,
that's correct.
And this event occurred in November 1979. You presented on this research at the 2008 UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas. Now, James, at that time, at the time of the crash, November 79, you were a rookie policeman with the Aberdeen Police Department in November of 79, and you do not know the crash's reported occurrence until 1986. But you learned the crash was still a major topic of discussion in the community.
That's correct. And actually, it was because, and this is something I would like to pass along to anybody who's listening. People should not be, if you are an advocate for this field, don't apologize and don't be afraid of what other people will tell you. A lot of times they're parroting what they've been told, and they're looking to have the courage of your convictions. Now, at the time that I first heard about this story, I was a young policeman. And it took me several years before I was established enough in my field that I was willing to bear the criticism and mockery of my fellow officers. And let me say that although policemen will put their lives on the line for each other, they are the most ruthless practical jokers and kidders and gossipers that I have ever met in my entire life. And I'm not sure that there's another group of people that's a close second. That makes them a lot of fun to work with, but you've got to be able to take a joke. So it took me a while before I could really get serious about UFOs, but eventually I did. And what I discovered was that after they quit joking about it, they all wanted to tell me what they had heard about Westport. And Westport is a town about 25 miles from Aberdeen, and there is a huge estuary there that eventually flows into the Pacific Ocean in Grays Harbor, and Elk River drains into that estuary, and the Elk River area is where the UFO crashed, and that's why sometimes it's referred to as the Elk River crash, and sometimes it's referred to as the Westport crash because Westport is the closest city to the crash, in the same way that Roswell, you know, the object did not actually crash in the city.
Yes.
But I started hearing more and more stories to include the man who had the most information was a sergeant who had the name Robbie Robertson, who had a naval intelligence background, and it turned out that he was the supervisor on duty for the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office the night that the object crashed. And this was on a Sunday night, late in November at 10:50 p.m., and you got to bear in mind that this is before everybody had a computer, before everybody had a cell phone, before everybody had enhanced 911 facilities, etc. But all of the switchboards of the emergency agencies in the county lit up because all kinds of people saw this thing coming across the sky. And the interesting thing was that even though I investigated it almost 7 years later, I was able to ask every witness, where did you see the object start from, and what direction did you see it leave in, and you could put them on a map and trace a line. So obviously this was a real event. There was no doubt that something came down out of the sky, that it was very fiery, and that it was seen by many people over a great distance. I mean, these are indisputable facts. The part where it gets interesting is that there was a woman, for instance, in Central Park who had a very vivid recollection of seeing something on fire go overhead and that it had windows and that her connection to it was almost intuitive or psychic. And she said, "My God, they're in trouble. They're on fire. They're going to crash." There were witnesses by the Elk River Bridge, which is the last bridge on State Route 105 going into Westport, who saw the object make a maneuver. And this was like a last-ditch maneuver. In other words, it turned, and it went out over the estuary and up the Elk River, I'm guessing either to avoid hitting the city of Westport or to avoid going into the Pacific Ocean. Whatever it was going down, it was out of control. Other witnesses said it described the object and said it had a red fiery tail, and they said it's out of power and going down. All the descriptions were very consistent. That's part one of the event. Part two of the event was I got lots of anecdotal stories, even all those years later, from people who didn't know or care anything about UFOs. But I had loggers who wanted to brag to me about how they tried to go to work on Monday morning and they got turned away by the soldiers and the jeeps. And they almost got into a fist fight, but these guys had rifles, so they decided they wouldn't fight with these soldiers. I had off-duty policemen describing how they drove through the area and saw military vehicles on the highway with equipment going into the area when they had never seen military vehicles down there at all. I had, for instance, a woman who said, "Don't know anything about UFOs, but I have a phone booth just down at the end of my driveway, and I saw an unmarked government car pull up, and a man with a high-ranking officer's uniform got out and went into the payphone and used it, and I've never seen anything like that." I had all these little stories that by themselves would just be very odd. But when you put them in context, they all fit together. I had people who say that they saw sky crane helicopters that were lifting something out. Another group said they saw a lowboy, a very large truck with something covered up on the back leaving the area. I mean, it's one of those situations where could I prove that every one of these stories was true? No, probably not. Would I be willing to say that given the number of stories that where there is smoke, there is fire, and that some portion of all of the stories was true and accurate? I would say definitely yes.
Boy, that's intriguing. You know, you describe here such consistency in witness accounts, in witness accounts, and a full spectrum of details, too, to add further to the credibility. Now, What I thought was interesting, at the time, there was an article in one of the newspapers, the Daily World, with the headline, UFO Wreckage in Elk River. And I'd like to also point to our audience an interesting article I found online. It's by Mike Marsh of the Daily World. I believe it was published Thursday, November 26, 2009, an unidentified anniversary Elk River UFO crash. And some really key facts in there, observations, and you're definitely referenced as the principal investigator of that particular event. Now, James, more on Elk River, the Westport crash. You note that there were three interesting elements, and here I'm referencing that reporter Marsh's article. Number one, the number of witnesses viewed that large flaming object. Number two, as you noted, there was a report by several of military presence in the area, and a logger informed you that military personnel would not permit him to go to his logging site. And also to that, the military cargo helicopters, and also, and you were referencing it was a former police officer. That must have been the former Elma police officer off duty at the time, seeing army trucks traveling on the highway toward Westport. Now, was that the what is the name of that truck? The large, what is that, large boy or something?
A low boy.
Very intriguing. Now, James, I'd like to go to a point now about the crash that's a bit conjectural, but I believe that there were several witnesses to this event. The report that a few days after the crash, a large craft with smaller craft was seen in the sky in the area and then quickly departed. And you referenced that event as the other search party.
That's correct. And the reason I say that is I didn't even realize until I actually tried to, I had a, what this was for several years was about a 2.5-inch thick file that I had in my file cabinet. I wasn't really sure what to do with this story. I had sort of written it off that this must have been someone's mistake. In other words, either our military or someone else's, something highly classified went off course. And rather than admit that it almost hit a small city, they decided to just cover it up and say they were never there. Well, that would be a hard one to prove, but I wasn't sure how that all fit together. But I got a report from a witness who voluntarily came forward in 1986 when I tried to solicit more witnesses, and he sent me this very detailed report, and I didn't realize until my wife pointed it out to me. She said, you need to really take a look at this report. And so I did, and it was by a man named Alan Raymer. Interestingly enough, Alan Raymer is a highly educated professional who does public outreach on wildlife in the Puget Sound area to include marine life. He lectures to schools. He's employed by the state of Washington, has been for many years. There is, in fact, a pretty well-known novel from the Pacific Northwest called The Highest Tide by a man named Jim Lynch, which is an excellent novel. And in there is a character who is a marine biologist. And the character in the book was patterned after Alan Raymer, my witness, who, by the way, was perfectly willing to be identified. He said he told the truth. He'll stand on it. He doesn't care whether anybody makes fun of him or not. He said that the day after the crash, and we reconstructed his personal schedule, where he was coming from, where he was going, exactly what he had done that day, and he was on his way home from work. It was Monday. He came back. He had been to the gym after work in Aberdeen. He was driving to his residence in Westport. He got about probably 2 miles from the crash site when he noticed a whole bunch of things at the same time. Cars ahead of him were pulled over, and people were getting out of their car or were already out of their car looking up at the sky, and there was one extremely large glowing object with 4 glowing objects behind it that were smaller. And he, of course, being a wildlife biologist, described these lights as like a mother duck with her ducklings, because wherever the one in front went, the ones behind it would sort of follow in a wavy line. Then while he was watching these lights, the big light went stationary. The smaller lights start of like buzzing around the big one, going in and out, in and out. And then all at once, all of the lights took off in different directions, and he emphasized over and over again that their speed was fantastic. It was way beyond anything that a conventional aircraft could do. And then they were all gone. And so that's why I sort of jokingly referred to this as the other search party, because I don't really know what else it could be.
Oh, that's well said. And, you know, also that anecdote to me just emphasizes the credibility of these witnesses. The witnesses are coming from a full spectrum of the community. Their word is to be taken seriously.
Exactly. And I guess that's a point I wanted to make. Originally was tonight when you mentioned that the difficult times that Dee Andrews is going through right now. And it reminded me of why I am still involved in UFOs, why I will never give up, why I don't apologize, and I am committed to this field. It's not just what we are going after, which is the proof that we are not alone, that we have been contacted by non-human intelligence. It's the people. It's the heart and that people put into these witness statements. You know, after a while when someone is really sincere and they're giving you their heart. And I know that that sounds odd coming from an ex-policeman, but I take pride in the fact that I still believe in people on a fundamental level. And when I meet someone like June or Dee or you or other people, Linda Moulton Howe, all of the many, many good witnesses that I've communicated with over the years who were doing their utmost to tell me what they sincerely and seriously experienced, I know why I stay in this field and why I won't give up. Because this is the path with the heart, because of what other people are sharing. I just wanted to throw that in, because that's why we are here, if you asked me that question.
Well, that's beautifully said. And, you know, James, we do have these excellent researchers, for example, Linda Moulton Howe, Joe Montaldo, and wonderful Dee. Now, Dee Andrew, I'm hoping she will be back with her live broadcast by sometime this summer. Dee is an outstanding researcher. We know she is going to totally be the victor over cancer. She is an expert on Roswell. I really can't wait to hear her speak at a conference. An excellent field historian, excellent researcher. Now, you're also referencing to how difficult it is for witnesses to come forward. Now, I'm wondering, earlier in the show you mentioned you had pilots who were friends, and you have two very powerful articles at your site. They concern two sightings at the Houston International Airport. One, the first article, references a sighting by, I believe it's three pilots, right in the cockpit. They were on the tarmac, and they saw a large, I believe it was a reddish-orange orb there near the airport, a very powerful sighting.
That is a very important sighting, because I happen to personally know the witness, and I promised him, in fact, the STAR team people were begging me to disclose his name, and I would not do it, because a promise is a promise. And if you've ever been a police officer, you don't burn your informants. That is something you just do not do. And so I couldn't. It's very interesting that at the same, that sighting occurred on August 9, 2009, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, within a day or so, in Arizona, we have two different sightings of strange red-orange spheres in the sky that were reported by off-duty pilots who made sightings from their residences. So basically we have all the same kind of thing going on. And at the same time, the thing that's really interesting to me about the Dallas sighting, which was 6 days earlier 21:30 hours, 9:30 in the evening, is that my friend who was the witness, his initial reaction to the UFO was anger. Because he has a plane full of passengers. They're waiting to take off. This is one of the world's busiest airports. And this UFO appears in restricted airspace over the airport, and his first reaction is, what is that idiot doing there? You know, you can't fly there. You know, we've got airliners full of people. That's why this is a restricted airspace. And then, the longer they looked at it, they realized that this really was crazy. It didn't make any sense. And then as he was turning the plane, he was going to report it to the tower. And his two co-pilots said, don't do it. And they were really petrified, both because of the, you know, possible repercussions for their careers, and also because it probably would have shut down the airport.
Yes, it would. And, you know, interestingly enough, too, you referenced in another article that in August, let me see here. Well, it was right in that area, well, time frame, September 17th, a couple viewed a very bright orange-red oblong object in the sky near Houston International Airport.
And so it's interesting. When you start having people, obviously, you know, this is what Investigations 101, too. I mean, if one person or one group of people report something, you go, well, okay, that's information, and if the person seems to be credible, that's probably good information. When multiple people start reporting the same thing, then obviously there's something going on. You know, I mean, that's just, and they're in different places and times and they don't know each other. Now you're starting to really get somewhere. I'm not sure where that somewhere is, though, because we still don't know what these mysterious objects are.
Absolutely, James. What are your thoughts on that? For example, which type of investigations would you particularly like to pursue now in this field?
Well, that's easy. I'm looking for my next June.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, that hands down is what I'm looking for. I kind of reached the, people have really valid sightings that they want to report, and there should always be an avenue for them to do that. And you never know what's going to come of it, because sometimes what seems to be a small sighting may turn into something larger. But I can also tell you as a experienced researcher that lights in the sky cases are generally extremely frustrating. And that, I believe, is the reason why Dr. J. Allen Hynek, when he was coming up with his UFO classification system a long time ago, why he had a category for them, lights in the sky. The reason is you usually go out the same door you go in. In other words, very seldom do you get anywhere with these cases, and if you solve it, it tends to be a conventional explanation, either man-made or astronomical phenomena. So, you know, in terms of where do I want to spend my time and energy, I want to interview people who have significant histories that contribute to some aspect of the mystery with a capital M. That's what I want to do.
Well, you know, I remember a reading from your bio, and you have a wonderful website, by the way, at ClarksonUFO.com. Back in 1966, you heard the radio broadcast of John G. Fuller when he was interviewed about the famous Exeter, New Hampshire UFO case. That began a lifelong quest to learn what is behind the mystery. That's fascinating. Your comments on that?
Well, that is, you know, for anyone who wants to study UFO history, if you want to go back and study some of the great cases, the Exeter, New Hampshire cases from 1963 are intensely interesting. What got me going in that was because even as a small boy, I was interested in law enforcement, and what I knew about policemen at that age, I thought, well, if police officers start reporting UFOs, we've really got something, because they're putting everything on the line. They're also trained professional observers. They're supposed to be dispassionate and objective. You know, not that they always are, but they try to be. And I'm all, even more interested now when you add in the categories of the military, pilots, and people like that. Anyone who takes a professional risk to make a UFO report, their reports get my attention. And I would just throw out there that if you took the combined evidence that has been presented by all of those professional people, I could prove that we have been contacted by non-human intelligence without putting any other descriptor on it. I could get a conviction or a proof in any court of law in the world. There is overwhelming evidence to support that statement.
I hardly agree. Hardly agree. James, do you think that given the excellent work, excellent research that you have done, you're joined by your colleagues in the field, do you think that perhaps there will be disclosure sometime within the next few decades? I know I have dear friends who tell me that it will never occur because there will be too many negative ramifications.
Well, anyone who wants to seriously research this, I would highly recommend the book that I just finished reading by Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel, which I believe is called After Disclosure.
Yes.
And that will cover that extremely well. And I would also mention that Richard Dolan is a brilliant man and another man that I highly respect, because if anybody can be called the UFO historian, it's him. UFOs and the National Security State is a great work that gives credibility to this entire field of research. But will there be disclosure? I think it's already occurring. The problem is you have to define what exactly disclosure is. And when we do that, we have to start saying, what will it look like? And I think the way that things change in history, we are not going to convince the secret keepers to give up being secret keepers. That's not going to happen. Especially, I don't foresee, given the problems that we're facing right now, the only way that there will be disclosure by our government is if something totally unexpected happens that forces them to disclose. In other words, right now there's no political or economic reason for them to take the risk of defending an extremely unpopular subject. And I'm not talking about unpopular with you or I or the people that agree with us, but I'm talking about society in general. But having said that, we are changing as people. We are growing more accepting of men having a different place in the universe. And the transformation is every bit as big, if not bigger, than when we quit thinking that the Earth was flat and we started thinking that the world was round, and gradually we decided there was a solar system, and then we decided that we were part of a galaxy, and now we've decided that we're part of a universe that keeps getting bigger with more and more stars in it. You know, we're already changing. And interestingly enough, I bumped into an article I wanted to briefly comment on. I read a strange article called The Hidden Message in Pixar Films. And Pixar, of course, does some of the best animated films out there, like Up or The Incredibles or Aliens and Monsters. Those are all Pixar films. Anyway, this article, it doesn't have anything to do with UFOs or aliens, but it talks about what we are taught, or what children are being taught by these movies. And the conclusion that they reach is that humanity does not have a monopoly on personhood. In whatever form non- or superhuman intelligence takes, it will need brave souls on both sides to defend what is right. And basically it goes on to say that, you know, whether you are good or evil or human or inhuman is determined by the choices that you make, not how you appear. And that this is the message that these movies are conveying. And if you start thinking about how we are being programmed, whether it is conscious or unconscious, I don't think most people are going to have a big problem if the aliens land, providing, of course, that they're not overtly hostile. But I don't think our government right now is going to disclose, unless it becomes politically expedient to do so.
Boy, those are intriguing comments, James. I want to thank you for this very informative discussion. I've learned a great deal. I know it's been appreciated by our virtual auditorium on Pal Talk, by our listeners, too, on the elsewhere on the network. And I also thank my friends here in the auditorium for their, as usual, excellent questions. James, thanks. I learned a great deal. I hope very much that you'll be a return guest later this summer.
I would love to.
Not to put you on the spot, but definitely would love to, again, have a very soon discussion with you. I learned a very great deal. I love it when I learn so much from these broadcasts. They're priceless to me. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for joining us for this very informative discussion with James, and have a wonderful weekend. James Clarkson's website can be found at clarksonufo.com. Congratulations on your excellent research, James, and on your beautiful telling of June Crane's story. A wonderful account, a very important account. And lastly, again, a wonderful birthday to Dee Andrew. Good night, everyone.
Who can say? the Unabridged Universe. Join us from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time, Saturdays, as host Jason Wilson and I, Victoria Rose, bring you the perspectives of guests on every topic, from extraterrestrials on the edge of the galaxy to issues that affect you right here at home. It's a big universe out there, and we're likely to cover anything. Do you have any topics that you'd like to have discussed? Know any researchers or free thinkers out there you'd like to have on the show? Log on to www.unabridgeduniverse.com and let us know, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.giascott.com.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know. I'm Irish.
Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus.